Four college students, one quiet Idaho town, and a night so silent it screamed. When a group of roommates is brutally stabbed in their off-campus home, a small community spirals into fear, and a survivor is left haunted by the footsteps they almost heard too late. As social media sleuths flood the internet with theories and the real killer walks free, the truth is darker than anyone imagined. Told from the raw, first-person perspective of the one who lived, College Town Massacre is a chilling journey through guilt, obsession, and the search for justice in a world where likes and hashtags blur the line between facts and fiction. This isn't just true crime, this is survival. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you College Town Massacre. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. We left the door unlocked. You never expect to wake up and find the world on fire. Not when it's been so quiet for so long. Not in a place like Moscow, Idaho. They say college towns are their own little bubbles. Separate from the real world. Sheltered. Maybe a little naive. And I believe that. We all did. I think it's easy to believe in safety when danger hasn't knocked on your front door yet. When you're 19, 20, 21, life feels endless. You're not thinking about death or monsters hiding in plain sight. You're thinking about exams, hookups, parties, shitty ramen dinners, and whether your crush liked your latest post. We were no different. Until we were. That weekend was supposed to be normal. A few drinks, a few laughs. Catching up before finals swallowed us whole. There were six of us living in that off-campus house. Me, Kayla, Mia, Zara, Ethan, and Olivia. Everyone kind of drifted in and out like satellites. People crashing after parties, sleeping off hangovers, staying the night after fights with boyfriends or breakdowns over term papers. We were close in that messy, codependent, late-night confession kind of way. Family by survival, not blood. That Saturday night, November 12th, 2022, started like so many others. Loud music. Stupid dance moves. A busted speaker propped up by textbooks. Mia had brought home a guy from her psych class, Ethan. Sweet kid. Always smiled like he was in on some joke no one else got. Zara made jello shots that tasted like cough syrup and bad decisions. Kayla was doing her eyeliner in the mirror with surgical precision, like getting that wing sharp was more important than anything else in the world. I was tired, burned out. I'd had a long-ass week working doubles at the coffee shop and cramming for my stats exam, so I bailed early and claimed the couch downstairs. I remember the cushions were uneven, and there was a faint whiff of old takeout clinging to the fabric, but it was warm. Safe. I scrolled through my phone until my eyes blurred. TikTok. Reddit. Dumb memes. Late-night ramblings from strangers who felt like friends. I liked that part, the loneliness of the internet shared together. The house started to quiet down around 2:45 a.m. Zara went up to her room. Mia and Ethan were giggling behind her door. Kayla was in her room texting some guys she swore she didn't care about. Olivia had gone home earlier after a fight with her boyfriend. Just me, the hum of the refrigerator, and the soft creaking of the house settling into itself. Then came 3:26 a.m. I remember it precisely because my phone buzzed. A Discord message. Nothing urgent, but it pulled me from that hazy brink between sleep and awareness. And then I heard it. A sound. A step. Maybe two. Not loud. Not crashing. Just deliberate. Like someone trying not to be heard. I sat up. Held my breath. The house had gone dead silent. The kind of silence that doesn't feel like rest, it feels like a warning. Zara. I called out. Nothing. Mia. No answer. I told myself it was one of them going to the bathroom. Or maybe Ethan had left. Doors creak. Floors settle. That's what old houses do. But something about the air felt wrong. Heavy. Too still. I should have gone upstairs. I should have checked. But I didn't. Because I didn't want to look paranoid. Because I was scared. Because part of me already knew. I fell asleep anyway. Or maybe I passed out. I'm still not sure. And then it was morning. I woke to sunlight bleeding through the curtain and the soft ping of my phone. It was almost noon. My back ached. My mouth was dry. I stretched, yawned, sat up. The first thing I noticed was how quiet it still was. No music from Kayla's room. No Zara stomping around complaining about hangovers. No giggling. No movement. Just silence. That silence again. I stood up, heart thudding in my chest like it already knew what was waiting. I walked past the hallway toward Kayla's door. It was slightly ajar. She always closed it when she slept. Always. My hand trembled as I pushed it open. There's no way to describe what I saw without making you sick. No easy way to tell it. Her bed was soaked. Deep, dark red pooling into the mattress. Her throat, God. I can't even write it. It was like something from a horror movie, except worse, because it was real. Because it was her. My knees buckled. I grabbed the doorframe just to stay upright. I screamed. I screamed until my voice cracked. I screamed so loud Olivia thought someone had set the house on fire. The police arrived within minutes. But they didn't rush in. They paused. One of the officers took a step back like his brain wouldn't let him go inside. Another muttered, "Holy fuck," before running out into the yard to puke into the bushes. That's when I realized it wasn't just Kayla. It was all of them. Zara. Mia. Ethan. For bodies. For kids who'd spent their final hours making dumb jokes and dancing to bad music. Gone. Murdered. Stabbed in the dark while the rest of us slept. No forced entry. No screams. Just erased. Quietly. Efficiently. Like we were nothing more than pages in someone's story they decided to rip out. And the worst part? The front door was unlocked. We always left it unlocked. We trusted each other. Trusted the neighborhood. Trusted the lie that bad things don't happen in good towns. We were wrong. Within hours, the media descended. First the locals. Then the big ones. CNN, ABC, CBS. Choppers in the air. Vans parked outside. But even that wasn't the worst part. It was the internet. TikTok turned our tragedy into content. Reddit threads exploded with theories. Strangers dissected our photos like they knew us. Accused survivors. Mocked the dead. People claimed they saw the killer in reflections, in windows, in shadows behind blurry screenshots. Some of them meant well. Some really thought they were helping. But most of them weren't looking for truth. They were looking for entertainment. And the killer, whoever he was still out there. Watching. Waiting. Maybe reading every post. Maybe laughing. And I kept thinking about that moment at 3:26 a.m. The creak. The footstep. What if I'd gone upstairs? What if I'd opened that door? Would I be dead too? Or worse, what if I saw him and just didn't know it? Chapter 2. TikTok detectives and shadows in the window. They always tell you to let the professionals handle it. Let the police do their job. Trust the system. But what the hell are you supposed to do when the system moves slower than your own heartbeat? And the professionals look just as lost as the rest of us. The day after the bodies were found, Moscow didn't just lose its sense of safety. It lost its goddamn mind. You could feel the fear bleeding out of every crack in the sidewalks, every coffee shop booth, every lecture hall. It was like someone had dumped ink into clear water. And now everyone was holding their breath, watching it spread. The university sent out a vague email that morning. Something about offering grief counseling, thoughts and prayers, and increased patrol presence. But the tone felt detached. Like they didn't know how to say, "We have a killer on the loose, and we don't know who the fuck it is." I didn't go back to the house. I couldn't. Not after what I saw. Not after what I smelled. The image of Kayla's room kept flashing behind my eyelids every time I blinked. Her throat. The way her hands were frozen mid-defensive, like she knew what was coming in those last seconds. Like she'd fought. Like she'd begged. I checked into a cheap motel on the edge of town. The kind with flickering hallway lights and paper-thin walls that let you hear every cough, every creak, every fuck. But at least it wasn't the house. At least I could breathe without smelling blood. The cops interviewed me that night. A detective named Hardy. Late 40s, tired eyes, smelled like stale coffee and cheap aftershave. He sat across from me in a chair that creaked every time he leaned forward. "Tell me everything you remember," he said, like he hadn't already heard the same thing on repeat four times. So I told him again. About the jello shots. The laughter. The creak in the hallway. The silence. The fucking silence. He scribbled notes on a yellow legal pad and nodded like he understood. But I could tell he didn't. No one did. Not really. The next morning, I turned on my phone, and the entire internet had exploded. TikTok. Reddit. YouTube. True crime channels. People who didn't know a damn thing about Moscow, Idaho, or what it felt like to live there, were suddenly experts. They called it the College Town Massacre. Some asshole even made a logo. Like it was a brand. They combed through our photos. They took blurry screenshots from Instagram stories and added ominous music to them. One clip showed Ethan laughing at the party. They slowed it down, zoomed in, and said he looked afraid. Another had Kayla dancing in the kitchen. Her last known video, the caption read, like her death was a fucking trailer for a horror movie. But the worst were the sleuths. They found our Venmo histories. They stalked our families. One girl made a whole series of TikToks claiming Olivia was the killer because she wasn't in the house that night. They left the door unlocked on purpose, she said in one. It was a drug deal gone wrong. No, it wasn't. It was a goddamn slaughter. An ambush. I kept scrolling, even though it made me nauseous. Like watching your own autopsy before you're dead. That's when I found him. Or at least, his eyes. A still frame. A shadow in the background of one of Zara's Instagram lives from the night of the party. She was showing off her outfit in the living room mirror. In the corner, barely visible, a figure passing by the kitchen window. Just one step. One blurred silhouette. But once someone pointed it out, that's all you could see. Commenters zoomed in. He's wearing black, they said. Look at the shape of the nose. That's not one of the roommates. Someone slowed it down frame by frame. They added filters. Adjusted contrast. A pixelated face began to take form. That's our guy, they said. Was it? Could be. Or maybe it was just a reflection. Maybe it was Ethan getting ice. Maybe it was nothing. But once the image hit TikTok's algorithm, it was over. It had millions of views within hours. Hashtag KingRoadKiller started trending. More evidence popped up, screenshots from Ring cams around the block. Footage of a white car idling on a nearby street. Sound bites of a scream someone thought they heard between 4 o'clock and 4:17 a.m. theories piled up like corpses. People accused one of the surviving roommates. Then they accused me. Then they accused Kayla's ex, then a delivery driver, then some random dude in a hoodie who lived 3 blocks away and once tweeted something edgy about murder podcasts. The town became a maze of whispers, of stares, of pointed fingers and shaken heads. Everywhere I went, I felt like prey. And worse, I felt guilty. Because deep down, I knew I'd heard something that night. And I did nothing. I froze. If I'd just gotten up, if I'd checked the hallway, if I'd opened the fucking door, maybe I'd be dead. Or maybe they'd still be alive. The guilt didn't let up, not even when the cops finally made their move. It was a Tuesday when I saw the news alert. Arrest made in College Town murders. Suspect, Brian K., age 28. PhD student in criminology. Criminology? I blinked at the headline like it was a joke. Like someone had AI generated the worst possible twist. But it was real. They said he'd been studying killers. Watching interviews. Analyzing patterns. He wrote papers on psychopathy and law enforcement behavior. He knew how cops worked. He knew how to move in silence. How to vanish. How to manipulate the scene. And he'd been so close. Just across the border. Washington State University. Less than 10 miles from where we lived. He wasn't a drifter. Not some shadowy figure lurking in the night. He was a fucking student. A face that blended in with the rest of us. Walked the same halls. Breathed the same air. I clicked on a photo of him in a classroom. His eyes were cold. Empty. Like he wasn't in there. That's when it hit me. He didn't just choose them at random. He studied them. He watched. Planned. He probably walked past our house a dozen times before the night he came in. Maybe he was even at the party, lurking at the edges. Maybe that shadow in the window wasn't a trick of the light. Maybe it was him. And suddenly it all felt worse. Because this wasn't just a murder. It was a goddamn thesis. And we were his final fucking project. Chapter 3. The Devil Wore Glasses. There's this weird thing that happens when they arrest someone like him. For a minute, just a minute, you breathe. You let out a breath you didn't even realize you'd been holding since the night, everything shattered. But then, almost instantly, that breath turns into something else. A scream. A knot. A question with too many teeth. How long had he been watching us? The first time I saw Brian K., in person I felt sick. Not just mentally, physically. Like my body was rejecting the very sight of him. He looked like someone you'd see in a coffee shop, typing away on a laptop with earbuds in, zoning out to lo-fi beats while drafting a term paper. But now I knew better. Now I knew he wasn't typing notes, he was building a blueprint. A step-by-step breakdown of how to erase 4 human lives without leaving behind a trace. Or so he thought. He had glasses. Wire-rimmed. Plain. Almost nerdy. His hair was thinning a little in the back. He stood with this weird posture, like he wasn't quite sure how tall he was allowed to be. But it was the eyes that did it. Cold. Glassy. Too focused. Too still. I was sitting behind the glass in the courthouse gallery, fingers locked tight around my phone. The room buzzed with tension. You could feel it pulsing beneath the floorboards. The judge spoke with clinical detachment, the lawyers shuffled papers, the guards flanked the walls like silent statues. But all I could focus on was him. He didn't look at us. Not once. Not at me. Not at the families. Not at the photos of the victims projected on the screen behind the prosecutor's desk. Zara, Mia, Ethan, Kayla. Their smiling faces were blown up on a 60-inch monitor like a cruel twist on a graduation slideshow. And he didn't blink. Not once. They said he'd been following them for weeks. That he used a fake name on Reddit to ask questions like, how do you control panic during a violent crime? What's the best way to plan an ambush on multiple targets? How does law enforcement collect DNA evidence from stab wounds? Stab wounds. He wasn't just curious. He wasn't just obsessed. He was rehearsing. That part crushed me. The rehearsal. Because that meant every moment of our joy, every stupid joke, every casual night with greasy pizza and spilled drinks and loud music, we were already dead to him. We just didn't know it yet. He watched us laugh. Watched them dance. Watched me fall asleep on the couch that night. He'd made up his mind. He was going to do it. And we were just waiting for our scene. After the hearing, reporters swarmed the courthouse steps. Microphones, cameras, shouting. Someone asked me if I wanted to give a statement. I stared at them. What the fuck do you want me to say? I snapped. That I survived? That I'm haunted? That I think about Kayla's face every time I close my eyes? There's no statement for this kind of trauma. There's just raw, bleeding silence. And a ticking clock that reminds you you're alive while others aren't. But the media didn't care. They wanted blood. Ratings. Reels. Clicks. And if they couldn't get answers from Brian, they'd get reactions from us. That night, I sat in my motel room watching a documentary that had already been rushed out by a true crime YouTuber. Barely 3 weeks since the murder, and this guy had graphics, narration, timelines, theories, even dramatic music drops. He called Brian the academic butcher. Disgusting. That's when the nightmares started. Vivid, sharp. Too real. I'd wake up soaked in sweat, thinking I'd heard footsteps again. Thinking someone was standing in the corner. Sometimes I dreamt I was back in that house. Only this time, I wasn't on the couch. I was awake. I was walking toward the stairs. I'd hear the floorboards creak and run toward the sound, but I was always too late. Every single time, I'd open Kayla's door and find her staring at me, not blinking, not moving, her mouth open like she was trying to say something, but couldn't. Sometimes, I think she's asking me why I didn't stop it, and I never have an answer. One afternoon, a detective came to visit me at the motel. Not Hardy, a younger guy. Miller. He brought a laptop and asked if I wanted to watch the footage. What footage? He hesitated. We recovered some surveillance. From houses in the neighborhood, Brian's car is visible. A white Hyundai Elantra. He passes by the house 3 times before parking. I didn't want to see it, but I said yes. The screen showed grainy footage. Night vision. A streetlight flickering in the corner. Then a shape. A white car creeping into frame. Stopping. Waiting. Then circling again. Over and over. That's the third pass, Miller said. He parks just out of view. Walks toward the house. Hoodie up. Mask on. Gloves. Did anyone see him go in? I asked. Miller shook his head. That's the thing. No cameras caught the entry, but one caught the exit. He clicked to a new clip. It was blurry, but you could see movement. A figure jogging away from the direction of the house. Head down. Fast. And then this still makes my chest cave in, he stopped. Turned. Looked directly at the camera. Just for a second. Then gone. Even through the blur, I could feel it. That awareness. He knew. He knew what he was doing. He knew how close he was to being caught. But he didn't care. I asked Miller if they found anything else. Motive. Manifestos. Notes. He nodded slowly. We found a folder on his laptop. Labeled experiment. Inside were files. Psychological breakdowns. Charts. Timelines. And us. I whispered. He paused. Yes. He had your names. Your schedules. Even screenshots of your social media. He followed every one of you. So it wasn't random. It wasn't wrong place, wrong time. It was fucking methodical. We weren't people to him. We were variables. Case studies. Just data points in a thesis he wanted to test in real time. And when I thought it couldn't get worse, Miller added one last thing. There was a draft email we found, he said. Unsent. It read, "They'll never catch me. They're too stupid to understand the pattern. I did this because I could. Because they deserved it. Because it's not about hate. It's about proof." Proof? Proof of what? That he could. That he was smarter. That lives were disposable. That night, I sat in the dark for hours, thinking about that sentence. They deserved it. He didn't know them. Not really. But he watched. He studied. He decided they didn't matter. He made them disposable. Because someone like him doesn't need a real reason. They just need a crack to crawl through. And we left the fucking door unlocked. Chapter 4. The weight of staying alive. They never tell you what comes after the arrest. You think the worst is over once the cuffs are on. Once the cameras flash and the perp walk hits the evening news. You think the nightmares will slow down, that your breath won't catch in your throat every time a floorboard creaks or a car idles outside your window. But that's a lie. The truth is, grief has no off switch. Trauma doesn't care that the guy's in a jumpsuit now. The terror doesn't stop just because someone says, "We got him." In fact, it gets worse. I thought I'd be able to sleep again, eat, think, but my body had other plans. I kept waking at 3:26 a.m. sharp, same minute every night, like a curse stitched into my skin. My brain had bookmarked that exact time like it was the final frame in a horror reel it couldn't stop replaying. Sometimes I'd stare at the motel ceiling for hours, counting the cracks in the paint, imagining what it would have sounded like if Kayla screamed, if I'd heard her, if I'd actually moved. The court proceedings crawled forward like molasses in January. Every day was a new detail, a new bombshell, a new reminder that justice is a process, not a moment. The prosecution laid out their case piece by piece, like bones on a table. The DNA on the knife sheath left under Ethan's body. The footprint outside Zara's door, Vans size 13. The cell phone records showing Brian's phone pinging near our house 12 times in the weeks before the murders. The trash from his family's Pennsylvania home, where they found matching DNA. And the search history. God, the search history. Where to stab to avoid screaming. Best state to commit murder. Does DNA degrade in cold weather? He Googled all of it. But still, he pled not guilty. Still, he showed up in court with that same blank stare. Still, he watched us like we were the ones on trial. I remember the first time I made eye contact with him, during the preliminary hearing. It was brief, just a flicker. But it was enough. Enough to send a chill up my spine so sharp I nearly threw up in the aisle seat. Because when I looked at him, I didn't see guilt. I saw curiosity. Like he was still observing us. Still taking notes. Still cataloging reactions like a goddamn scientist. It was like we were insects under a microscope, and he was fascinated by how we twitched when poked. I couldn't take it. I walked out of the courtroom halfway through the presentation of the crime scene photos. The moment they showed Mia's arm, curled under her head like she'd tried to shield herself, I felt something inside me fracture. I made it to the bathroom just in time to vomit into the sink. You know what's fucked up? There were fans. Not of the victims. Not of the town. Of him. Brian K. had a group of online supporters. Women who called him misunderstood. Who posted thirst traps in orange jumpsuits. Who sent letters to the jail. Who wrote that he had sad, poetic eyes. Poetic? He butchered for people in their sleep. He planned it. He executed it. And then he went to class the next day and discussed forensic countermeasures with his professors like he hadn't just drenched our walls in blood. But the internet romanticizes pain, packages it, monetizes it, turns it into content. Brian wasn't just a murderer to them, he was an aesthetic. I spent hours doom scrolling. I don't know why. Maybe to punish myself. Maybe because I needed to feel something real. But the more I read, the more detached I became. I couldn't cry anymore. I couldn't even scream. All I could do was float above myself, watching a ghost live my life. I stopped responding to texts. My parents begged me to come home. My professors offered incompletes. One of them left a voicemail. You don't have to prove anything. You survived. But that's just it. I didn't feel like a survivor. I felt like a fucking coward. I started seeing a therapist. Her name was Lydia. Calm voice. Big glasses. She let me sit in silence for the first 5 sessions without forcing me to talk. Session 6, I cracked. I should have done something, I whispered. What would you have done? She asked gently. I don't know, I said. Gone upstairs. Screamed. Fought. She looked at me for a long moment, then said something I still think about every night. You lived. That was the only thing you could do. And the weight of staying alive is heavier than you think. She was right. Surviving isn't peaceful. It's violent in its own way. Every day is a battle against the memory of what you didn't do. What you couldn't change. The courtroom became a stage for all our grief. Family after family read victim impact statements. Zara's mom sobbed so hard she collapsed halfway through hers. Ethan's younger brother said he still sat two places at the dinner table by accident. Mia's dad just stood in silence, holding up a photo of her as a baby until the bailiff had to help him sit down. And me, I didn't speak. I couldn't. My voice felt like glass, too fragile to carry the weight of what I wanted to say. Instead, I wrote a letter, sealed it, gave it to the DA. I don't know if Brian ever read it. I doubt he cared, but I had to try. I had to say what I never got to say to my friends. To Kayla, I'm sorry I didn't move. I'm sorry I didn't fight. I miss you. I miss you every goddamn day. And I promise, I won't let the world forget you. That was the only vow I could keep. But that wasn't the end. The prosecution made their announcement that week. They were pursuing the death penalty. It didn't make me happy. It didn't bring closure. But it felt like something. Like maybe, just maybe, this monster would finally face a punishment big enough to match the hole he left behind. Still, part of me couldn't help but wonder, was death enough? Or was that letting him off too easy? Because I think deep down Brian K. wanted to be a martyr, to die for his experiment, to become legend. And maybe the real punishment would be the thing he never planned for. Living. Alone. Caged. Forgotten. No thesis. No fame. No following. Just time. Endless, meaningless time. And the echo of all the lives he destroyed. Chapter 5. Ghosts in the Silence. Time doesn't heal everything. That's another lie they tell you to make the silence feel less violent. Time doesn't erase the blood soaked into floorboards. It doesn't dull the weight of the what-ifs. And it sure as hell doesn't bring anyone back. But time does something. It warps. It replays. It turns sharp edges into haunting lullabies you start mistaking for background noise. It's been a year. 12 months since the night Moscow lost its innocence. Since four lives were carved out of existence like they were disposable. Since I learned the hard way that monsters don't hide under beds. They walk among us in hoodies and glasses and PhD seminars. The trial was set for early next year, but with all the motions, appeals, and the death penalty on the table, it got delayed. Again. And again. Legal games. Strategy. The dance of justice. The truth is, I stopped waiting for the system to make me whole again, because it never will. So I made my own kind of closure. And that started with going back to the house. It sat there all this time vacant. Boarded windows. Overgrown weeds. A silent monument wrapped in yellow caution tape and shadows. People drove by sometimes. Slowed down. Took pictures. Some lit candles. Others just stared like it was a zoo exhibit. I avoided it for as long as I could. But on the 1 year mark, I couldn't stay away anymore. It was cold. November cold. That kind of Idaho chill that made your lungs tighten when you stepped outside. I stood across the street, hands in my pockets, watching the house like it might breathe or scream or vanish if I looked at it too long. Then I crossed the street. The door wasn't locked. The cops had cleared it months ago, but no one wanted to claim it. A realtor's sign sat crooked in the front yard, half covered in frost. The second I stepped inside, I felt everything shift. The air was heavier, denser, like it remembered. The furniture was gone, but the ghosts weren't. You could feel them in the walls, like static clinging to your skin. I walked the halls slowly, my footsteps echoing in the emptiness. The living room, where we used to throw pillows at each other during movie nights. The kitchen, where Zara once set a pan on fire trying to make pancakes. The hallway, where Kayla would sneak out late at night thinking no one noticed. The staircase that led to the bedrooms I never got to say goodbye to. I climbed it one step at a time, my hand trailing the rail, my pulse thick in my ears. I opened Kayla's door last. It was empty now. Bare walls. Stained carpet. But I could still see her there, laughing at something stupid I said. Dancing while brushing her teeth. Telling me to stop being so emo and come to the damn party. I sat down on the floor and just let it happen. The tears. The memories. The guilt. I talked to her. Out loud. "I'm sorry," I said. "I should have checked. I should have opened the door." I don't know if she heard me, but I needed to say it anyway. When I stood up, I felt lighter. Not healed, but cracked open enough to breathe. That night, I opened the letter I wrote and never sent. The one meant for Brian. It wasn't a confession. It wasn't even a threat. It was a reckoning. "Dear Brian, you'll probably never read this, but I want to say it anyway. You failed. Not just as a human being. Not just as a man. You failed as a scientist. As a mind. As a monster. You thought this would make you immortal. You thought your name would echo forever. But let me be clear. You are already fading. You didn't create terror. You didn't instill fear. You created something else. You created us, the ones who stayed, the ones who remember, the ones who speak, and we're louder than you'll ever be. You took lives, but you didn't erase them. We carry them now, in our tattoos, in our tributes, in the way we fucking live. You thought you wrote the last chapter, but this isn't your story anymore. It's ours, and we're still writing it. Me, I folded the letter and burned it that same night. Watched it curl to ash in a trash can behind the motel. And for the first time in months, I didn't feel helpless. I felt defiant. A week later, I moved out of the motel and back into a real apartment. Small, quiet, just outside town. I didn't go back to school. Not yet. Maybe never. But I started volunteering, helping trauma survivors, speaking at schools, telling our story the way it should be told. Not as clickbait. Not as the Idaho murder house. But as the story of four vibrant souls whose lives were stolen, yes, but not forgotten. There's a mural now, across from campus. Their faces. Bright. Alive. Kayla's smile, Ethan's grin, Zara's confidence, Mia's fire. Students pass by every day. Some take selfies. Some leave flowers. And when the trial finally starts, if it ever does, I'll be there. Not to see him, but to remind him that we're still here. That we survived. That we fucking matter. Some nights, I still wake up at 3:26 a.m., but I don't panic anymore. I sit up, breathe, and I talk to them. You're not gone. You're just somewhere softer now. Somewhere quiet. And I will keep speaking your names until this world forgets his. Because even in silence we rise. And we never stop writing.